Morning, family. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. My name's Chris. Wow, that's a lot to live up to. Holy mackerel, I will certainly do my best. You know, let me address one of the things that Wayne mentioned. You know, it is a privilege to come up here. It is a privilege to be a part of this workshop, and the guys that I bring, honestly, I would not be here without all of them. Even more candidly, if you are one of the heavy hitters in the room, if you could stand up as well as my guys, if you guys could stand up for a second. Heavy hitters, come on, stand up. There's a reason that I mention these guys specifically. I mean, I'll talk about it in my story here in just a second, but these guys work a program, and I mean, they're not the only ones by any stretch of the imagination, but they were just the group that I happened to fall in with, and man, they take the program seriously while following Rule 62, so that's important. As I said, I am a grateful member of several fellowships. My sobriety date is April 1st of 2003. That was not my first sobriety date or my first last sobriety date. That was August of 2002. My home group is Common Solutions CA meeting in Charleston, actually West Ashley specifically. So if you get a chance to come down, we would love to have you. It's a fantastic group. I've got a sponsor. My sponsor is here this morning, and my grand sponsor is also here. As I said, you guys saved my life. This workshop saved my life, and as an extension of that, that's where my sponsorship comes from. I also have sponsees that I've talked about. I mean, they're here. You know, listen, guys, that's what this is all about. And so when you get a chance to talk on Sunday morning, obviously we're going to talk about a walk with a higher power. But I can't do that walk without those guys, right? And so the three legacies, and this is part of my opinion, and I'll try very, very diligently to separate my opinion from the black letters in the book. But my opinion, the three legacies exist to prop up that walk, right? So, I mean, recovery obviously is the foundation, but without service, there is no recovery, right? And those things that go together to make up this program are how we do this, and I don't get sober without you guys. So I want to talk about a couple of things today, three really important things. How many of you guys have seen the movie Hacksaw Ridge by chance? Or no? All right, yeah. So how many of you all remember the prayer that the private said before going out into the battlefield? Well, in my opinion, that prayer is why we are doing this, right? And his prayer, for those of you that don't know it, is, Lord, please help me just get one more. Please help me get just one more. That's exactly why the Atlanta Men's Workshop has existed since 1982. And that's why it has thrived since 1982. Because if we help make an impact in the lives of just one guy, that's a start, right? You know, Dr. Bob says that we have an answer for you. A lot of us feel that we have the answer, but he says that we have an answer. Part of that answer, and it's a bit more rigid discussion, but is finding and understanding your higher power. And he's got a pretty specific way of putting that on page 181. You know, that being said, God, in all of its forms between the big book and the 12 and 12, is mentioned over 300 times. And so that's probably a pretty important thing to talk about. So let's get into it. So the first thing that you guys should know about me is, look, listen, left up to my own devices, I am simply not to be trusted, right? I will make bad decisions on just about every occasion. And while that's still not necessarily true today, if you pour a whole lot of alcohol and drugs alcoholically on top of me, I am just a litany of bad decisions following one right after another. And the reality is that for me, I'll blame everybody else. It won't be my fault. It couldn't be my fault. Because I had to tell myself the big lie, right? The big lie was not the one that I told to you about who stole your money or what I did to steal your car or do whatever. The big lie was to me that I had everything under control and that I wasn't affecting anybody else. And that's the only way that you get to prop up an addiction like mine, is to continue to tell myself that everything's fine. The other thing that's kind of interesting about my story, and probably not necessarily interesting to some of you, you probably recognize it, but I didn't grow up in a big church home. We didn't have a real big influence of God. I like to tell folks that the church that we went to, some of you all will recognize it, it was St. Mattress of the Springs, right? The church of the usual holiday, you get what I'm saying? I mean, we went for holidays, we went for Easter, Christmas, and family events, whether it was weddings or funerals. That was about it. And, you know, the reason that, at least for me, that that's important is that when I first got here, man, I had a real heartache against God. I was bent sideways against God. I did not want to hear about it. I didn't want to talk about it. And, you know, that was a difficult early on part of my journey. But the reality is that you all very kindly, very quietly, and very sternly in some of the cases, taught me that walk, taught me how to have a relationship with a God of my understanding. And for that, I'm absolutely grateful. You know, the other thing that's important to note, the first step, and I'm not going to get too far into that, but, you know, the first step talks about unmanageability and powerlessness. When I first got here, I had absolutely no problem telling you whatsoever that I was powerless over drugs and alcohol. Absolutely fully admitted it. But the unmanageability piece, that was a whole different story. Because I didn't see the unmanageability. I just kept lowering the bar. I just kept lowering the standards by which I lived and said that everything was manageable. That was, again, part of that lie, right? But that was kind of the way things have gone, you know, even very early on, even as an early child. I was always out of control, and I was always blaming other people, other situations for a lot of my actions, right? I'm going to try and keep my drinking history brief because I know everybody's got one, but I will tell you the first drunk that I had, and I was a blackout drinker from the very beginning, and I got into drugs alcoholically very shortly thereafter. But my first drink was a New Year's Eve party that my folks held. All the kids were downstairs. All the parents were upstairs. You probably recognize that story. And the other thing that was downstairs was all the wine. Now, I am 10 years old, a bunch of little kids running around, some older kids, and I said, well, certainly if it's good enough for the parents, it's got to be good enough for us. So I cracked some open and tried to get some of the other kids to drink, and I don't remember, honestly, if they did or they didn't, but I do remember this very specifically. When I came to, here come all the parents downstairs to get their kids. And they're waking me up and, oh, you know, look how cute. And there wasn't any consequence out of that. No consequence whatsoever except all the parents going, you know, look how funny and look how cute that is. And that was kind of how I equated my entire addiction history from there on out. Right? It's just that I couldn't have any consequences. And, you know, listen, there were times where others kind of helped me prop it up. I'm not putting it on them, but, you know, there were a lot of times where folks just said, well, that won't happen the next time. That won't be the same way the next time, right? I wish I could tell you the difference. It's always at this point, too, that I like to point out and apologize to those of you in the crowd that are in law enforcement. I only bring it up because I managed to rack up a few more than 7, a few less than 9 DUIs over my tenure. I know. I don't know how you do that today, to be perfectly honest, so I don't recommend going out and rewriting your story to try that again because I don't think you get away with it, right? But, you know, man, the 8 DUIs, again, just the countless times of things that I had gone through to get to this place. And the reality is that everywhere I went, that powerlessness and unmanageability and that hole inside me, everywhere I went, that went with me. Right? And it was, I was always fighting, always searching for something, and I did not know what that was. And you all in law enforcement and a lot of folks in the judicial system, I was court-ordered into the program, as I said, at least on 8 different occasions, and I'd walk in and do what a lot of us good court-appointed guys do. We walk in, we get our names signed, right? And then after a little while, you start to learn the names and learn the faces, and you may or may not be truthful about who signed it, and next thing you know, you got your friend signing it for you, right? Recognize that? No, right. But, you know, I wasn't interested in stopping. And the reason that I wasn't interested in stopping, I knew you guys had a solution. You guys looked happy. You guys looked like you were having a great time. But part of the reason that I just wasn't interested in stopping is that I didn't want to hear the solution. I didn't want to hear that solution to fill that God-sized hole was right here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, right here in the rooms of CA, of NA. The further along that I got in my addiction journey, man, oh man, I mean, that just escalated. I'd be the guy sitting in the bar, banging my drink on the bar. Oh, those alcoholics, they're just a bunch of quitters. Right? Yeah, you guys are just a bunch of quitters. I should have given that up a long time ago. I had every chance. Right? And as I look back on it, you know, that's the other thing that's important to note. Man, I cannot tell you the number of times that God gave me the opportunity. He gave me an exit ramp. Very clear. Presented it right in front of me. And I didn't take it. I could have. You all offered the opportunity countless times. And I said, no, thank you. Just didn't want it. You know, the other thing that came out from my addiction is I can't tell you the number of times that I was in the hospital. You know, you get, you always, how many of you street pharmacists out there, you try to manage the alcohol, right? The drunk with the drugs, right? And for me, I don't know about you guys, but I'd always overshoot the mark. I'd always overshoot the mark, right? And I'd get too drunk, and then I'd have to try and manage that and bring that down. And then next thing I know, I wound up in the hospital, and I'm paranoid, and I'm freaking out, and you know, you guys are out to get me, the doctors, nurses, all that, everybody's out to get me. And I'm miserable. But my heart's pounding a million miles an hour, because I don't know where I am, don't know what I'm doing, and I don't want your help. Despite all that, I don't want your help. And that was a scary proposition. You know, each time, each calamity, you know, it just was one right after another. I just continued to lower that bar. And I kept searching for what I did not know the answer to be. I knew there was an answer out there, and I thought that it was in the bottom of the bottle, to be honest with you. I thought that it was hanging around you guys. Right? Because, you know, what we would do is we'd wind up at the same parties, we'd wind up at the same bars, we'd wind up on the same park benches or whatever it was. And we try to figure out which one of us was going to wind up giving up more of their stash than the other one while the other one walked away. Right? Because that's the way it happened for me. And that's the way I tried to live my life because I thought that that was a relationship. It wasn't a relationship. It wasn't even an acquaintance. Right? It was just us trying to get over on one another to try and further the addiction. I do want to mention one key thing, and I mentioned that I had a pretty big heartache for God very early on, and I'll try to keep it less than graphic. But I recognized by the time I was 17 that my path was a tough one. I went about trying to get sober. Now, I did it on the marijuana maintenance program, so let me just caveat that. But I did quit everything else, if that's something to pat myself on the back about. And I was dating this young lady at the time, and I happened to go to another fellowship through the church. And we were on a church retreat, and we were all coming home, and it was on that trip home that I found out that the minister from that church was involved with some of the young ladies in our group, one of which happened to be the girl that I was dating. Right? Yeah. And that was my end, as far as I was concerned, with God and with the church. I was done. You know, I didn't give any credence to the fact that he's a human being just like we are, and he deserves grace and forgiveness, and that's a whole other story for a whole other time. But right then and there, I just decided that God, you know, he didn't need me, he didn't want me, I didn't need him, I didn't want him. I completely blocked out anything that might have been, as I said earlier, that off-ramp that a God of my understanding provided me to get out of the life that I was living. And for the next 16 years, roughly, I mean, that was exactly what I did. And I continued to pile on and pile on and pile on. Fast forward really to the last couple of years of my addiction. As I said, my sobriety date is 02, and the last couple of years certainly included a lot of impactful events, 9/11 among them, right? Had some friends and family members up there. But just the last 2 years were absolutely miserable. And I did everything that I possibly could to drown everything out. And it's the effectiveness kind of came to its end. And along the way, here I am manipulating every situation, telling everybody, no, I'm good. I got this. Meanwhile, my disease is escalating. Till June of 2002. So the woman who is my ex-wife, she and I were dating at the time. And I come to find out that this is one of these God moments later on, and it was pointed out to me when I did my first four-step, but this was my first God moment, right? So we were dating. Our anniversary, I woke up like I always did from a blackout, and she's kind of sitting there already awake. And she has her gift for me. And I did what any good alcoholic would do, right? You open the present. First thing you do, right? It's about me, right? You're going to open the present. And then she looked at me and she said, well, where's mine? And I did it again, what any good alcoholic will do. I said, I've ordered it and I got to go pick it up. Right? And I know you guys know the rest of the story. I left and came back roughly 4 or 5 hours later. And I mean, I was in the bag, as they say, right? I mean, I was terrible. And I don't remember much of that 4 hours, but the one thing that I do remember is walking back through the door and seeing the look on her face. And the reason that that's important is that from that day until August of that year, when I checked myself into treatment, I did everything possible to try and erase that look on her face, that look of sadness and despair and anger and frustration. I did everything I possibly could, poured everything I wanted to on that, and I could not erase that memory. I just couldn't do it. The addiction that had taken over, the solution stopped being the solution. It didn't work anymore. I couldn't blot out all the things that I was trying to blot out. And I was like, my gosh, now what am I going to do? Right? So that was one of the first, I guess, God moments. The other one was when I called her. I actually called her at the end of July, very last day in July, in a blackout, by the way. I had to be told all this later. Called her in a blackout. Talked to the AA hotline in a blackout. Yeah. And got into treatment in a blackout as a direct result of her and the very nice young man who was on the other end of the AA hotline, who, by the way, still does a ton of service work. He works for our Tri-County Intergroup in Charleston. Been there ever since. He was my first temporary sponsor. Right? And I checked myself into treatment. Now, I didn't check myself into treatment for the solution, or so I thought. I checked myself into treatment because I just, man, I was in a bad way. I get there, And for those of you that that did it right up until the very end, you probably recognize this. They put you on Thorazine. And the Thorazine shuffle is an interesting place to be. So for those of you that get there for the first time, what happens is they put you in your paper pajamas with the socks, with the non-skid stuff on the bottom of them, and they essentially sit you in a chair. And you stare out into space for the vast majority of the day, except when mealtime comes and then you walk back, right? You gotta be led back. And I'm sitting there, almost legitimately drooling on myself, thinking, man, I've chosen poorly. This was a bad decision. You know what I mean? I was, oh my gosh, did I make a bad decision. Here comes another God moment. So I'm in treatment, and Thorazine's gone, and I'm just, you know, going to meetings, and you all were kind enough to bring in a meeting. And I appreciate you for it. And one of the panelists said, after the talk, there were three panelists, and one of the guys got up and he said, listen, I want you to look to your left, I want you to look to your right. I want you to recognize that only 1 in 10 of you is ever going to enjoy anything like long-term sobriety. Now, I don't know what it was that hit me when he said that. I truly, to this day, I still don't know what it was. But I said, my gosh, I mean, given my history, that certainly was not going to be me. And it scared me to no end. And I still had another 2 weeks left on my treatment program, or roughly. And that's all I thought about for 2 weeks. I mean, my gosh, you know, what am I going to do when I get out of treatment? Because treatment, I mean, it was a kind of a safe place, right? You're locked inside, away from the confines of what it is that we like to do. But I have 2 weeks to think about, well, what am I going to do on the other side? And I'm sitting there having this conversation with myself and trying to figure out my solution when I get outside. And I'll never forget, the counselor came to me and said, well, listen, your release day's tomorrow. We've got to talk about that. And I said, yeah, we absolutely do, because you can't let me out of here. I mean, as I said before, I'm simply not to be trusted. You can't let me out of here. That's dangerous for me. And, you know, generally for society as a whole, if I'm being candid, right? But I'm talking to him, and he says, listen, you know, what I would suggest is going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he handed me a schedule. And I got out at 2:30 or 3 o'clock that afternoon. And the very first meeting on that schedule, or the closest meeting, was a meeting, for those of you that know anything about Charleston, it was the Remount Road location. 5:30 in the afternoon. In North Charleston. And for those of you that know anything about Remount Road in North Charleston, it's right back in the same neighborhood that I was in doing what I was doing before. But I was desperate. I said, man, I cannot live like this anymore. I just can't do it anymore. So I went to that meeting. And then that night I also went to the next meeting, which is actually to be my home group, West Ashley Group, again in Charleston. If you get a chance, go on down to that meeting too. It's phenomenal. But the reason that I bring up the Remount Road group and the West Ashley group, they had some guys in there that were all about service. And again, as I said, left up to my own devices, I'm simply not to be trusted. And so I asked one of the guys, I said, well, listen, what do I do? Because I'm afraid to go home. I'm afraid to go. I mean, I was good getting to the meeting from my house. But what was I going to do for the extra 22 and a half hours out of the day? Because if I was showing up early for the meeting and leaving late, what was I going to do for those other 22 and a half hours? I didn't have you. I couldn't take a meeting home with me, although I wanted to. And they said, well, I'll tell you what, you show up here early tomorrow and we'll talk to you about some service work. And I started making coffee. And I started greeting. I started setting up chairs. And it was that point that I found my first temporary sponsor. And by the way, it was also about that time that I met the guy that introduced me to the Atlanta Men's Workshop. Right? And we're pretty suggestible when we first get here, aren't we? The guy walks up to me and says, man, you gotta go to this place. You are not gonna believe it when you see it. Now, what's really, the other part of my story is Not only am I not to be trusted, but I will do everything that I can possibly do on a regular basis to torpedo a good situation for myself. I will tear it down if I can possibly do it. And when I showed up here for my first workshop, I brought all the stuff that I had intended to bring, you know, rollerblades and golf clubs and all the rest of it, not to do the workshop. Right. I was going to come up here and goof off, basically. But what I found when I got here was so much more. I mean, it was so much more impactful. So that was October of 2002. Now, I said that my sobriety date is April of 2003. Now, you guys have probably recognized this unmanageability. So along about December of 2002, mind you, I'm on fire for the program. But I said, you know, this is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a dealer friend of mine called and said, well, I've got some pretty good alcoholic drugs. You want them? I said, sure. I said, what, any good alcoholic? Absolutely, I want that. And what did I say? I know you guys have said it. This is a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They can't tell me about drugs. Right? Yeah, that's exactly right. You can't tell me about drugs. The other thing that I did not do, by the way, I did not run it by my my significant other at that time. Right? What else did I not do? I didn't call my sponsor. Oh, yeah. No, didn't call my sponsor. I didn't run it by him. And then finally, my girlfriend at the time kind of busted me, and she said, "You know, I don't think that's right." I gave her all my rationales. I gave her all my same lines, and she said, "I don't think that's right. I think you need to talk to your sponsor." I said, "I'm not talking to that guy. Are you kidding me?" Right. And I came up here in March of 2003, and I started talking to some of you guys about it. They said, "I don't know, but I think she's right. You might want to talk to your sponsor about that." And so, of course, I called him on the way back from the workshop. Certainly all defiant. And I said, "Look, man, I'm going to tell you something. I've been getting hot. It's a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't tell me anything about it." And he kind of chuckled, like he did a lot. They said, "Well, yeah, I mean, you can do that. You know, that is a way. Not the way, but that's a way." He said, "You know, you got really a couple of choices. The way I see it, you can either go to NA and pick up a medallion over there and manage two different sobriety dates, or you can choose to stick with the fellowship that you've been hanging around in for the longest time. You can just pick up another white ship." So again, I did what any good one of us would do. Stomped around for about a week. And I don't know what he's talking about, jerk. And I went and picked up another white ship, begrudgingly. Right? And I bring it up because, you know, along this journey with you guys, because I'm making phone calls to many of the phone numbers that I had gotten from that March workshop, and I'm calling you and asking your opinion, because I want to get a different opinion, right? I didn't want my sponsor's opinion, but after I picked up the white chip, I'm calling all these guys feverishly. "Hey, listen, let me tell you what happened. What do you think? Did I get a raw deal? Oh, I was waiting for you guys to agree with me." Right? Yeah. "Did I get a raw deal?" No. "Oh, come on, man. Somebody." But along the way, what I found out, that this whole time, God was doing for me what I absolutely could not, and in most occasions, would not do for myself. Would not do for myself. Before I get into talk about what it's like here now, I do want to back up. As I said, you know, God had proven to me on countless occasions that He was doing for me what I could not and would not do for myself. And I know a lot of you guys recognize this story. It's a usual story, but I was supposed to have been in the middle of addiction. I was supposed to have been at a Thanksgiving party with my roommate from college. And this is really where the consequences for me started to escalate. But the significant part about this, and it came out of my fourth step, I was supposed to be at that party with my friend, and he was stabbed and killed in a drug deal gone bad. And that's, you know, kind of the beginning of what happened to a lot of my acquaintances from that time. And again, I was supposed to be at that, and I was called to go do something else for a family member, which I only did if I was going to go prop up my addiction somewhere else, because I had to get something out of them as well. And when I got that phone call from his girlfriend, I was actually dating his girlfriend's sister at the time, but when I got the phone call from his girlfriend, I looked down at my phone and I said, well, that's kind of strange. I answered the phone and she told me what had happened. And when I sat down and I did my first four step, again with my first sponsor, he said, you know, that was one of those God moments. So what are you talking about? He said, that was God doing for you what you could not do for yourself. That was God asking you to be somewhere else because he knew what would have happened had you been there. I thought, well, that's pretty cool. And he said, well, now let's talk about the second step. I said, you jerk. You suckered me into it, didn't you? You know, when we get into the step work, that was... those awakening moments for me happened after 3, after 5, after 7, after 9, and after 12. And you guys along that way, I think you, I've heard a couple of people said it like this, but you kind of bamboozled me, right? I didn't want to talk about God to begin with, but you were absolutely certain that we were going to talk about God. And what I found out is that to get a God of my understanding, all I had to do, at least initially, was just believe that you guys believed. I didn't have to do anything special. I just had to believe that you believed. And I also had to believe that I wasn't that higher power. Because as I said before, left up to my own devices, I'm simply not to be trusted on every occasion. One funny story, this is several years into sobriety. I called my sponsor at the time, and I had a friend who was living on the West Coast, and he invited me out to Burning Man. And I said, sure, that'd be a great time. Now, for those of you that don't know what Burning Man is, it's this enormous music festival held in the desert, and you can imagine what happens at the enormous music festival. But I called my sponsor, and I said, hey, listen, I got this idea. He said, I've been thinking. He said, oh, really? He said, do tell. I said, well, listen, I'm going to go out to Burning Man and I'm going to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right. He said, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. And of course, what I did when I was, I hung up the phone, jerk. Didn't let me do what I wanted to do. But again, God doing for me what I could not do for myself. I had to take some suggestions. I had to listen to you guys. Because he wasn't right. He wasn't wrong. I mean, listen, I love music festivals. And I know what goes on. I know what happens. I've, you know, been passed out of too many of them to even tell you about. And so the last place that I need to be is carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous alone in a music festival of, I don't know, 40, 60, 70,000 people, right? Here, me carrying my big book. Here, I got the solution right here. Right? I mean, that's insane. But it's those God moments that I now recognize through good sponsorship and working with you guys and coming here that I get to recognize those God moments. You know, when I was out there doing what I was doing, when I was out there pouring a whole lot of drugs and alcohol on my situation, the one thing that I did is I blotted out the ability to recognize a God moment for really what it was. Right? And in the big book, in the family afterward, one of my favorite lines, and my you see my sponsees rolling their eyes before I even say it, but one of my favorite lines of the book is in the family afterward. It says, cessation from drinking is but the first step away from a highly strained and abnormal condition. Well, you know what? Not only am I that highly strained and abnormal condition from time to time, still to this day, But you pour drugs and alcohol on me, I am absolutely that highly strained and abnormal condition. But with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous and with you guys, I get to take a step away from that. I get to take a step back and I get to analyze my behavior. I get to analyze my actions. I get to analyze my first decisions, like calling my sponsor and saying, hey, I'm going to go to Burning Man and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to analyze that and go, you know, that first idea is probably not a real smart one. Because that's going to go badly for me. Because that's what I have to be careful of, is I'll start to justify all of these things that are away from the practices and the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as soon as I've done that, it starts my wheels turning. And that's when I call you guys and I say, hey, listen, I have this fantastic idea. Right? And what do you guys say? Uh-oh, you're thinking again. Right? You've been thinking again. Let's hear it. And then you laugh at me. And then we hang up and I've got a resentment for a couple of days. I've got to add to my four step. Those God moments, I get the privilege to recognize those today. Now, honestly, we don't have a whole lot of time to talk this morning about all of those God moments, but I do want to talk to you about one really significant one, and it happened to me here October of 2003. So as some of you know, there's some meetings that are off the books, as it were, not on the schedule. One of which is the third and seventh step prayer at the chapel, Saturday afternoons, right before dinner, 5 o'clock. For those of you that made it, I'm excited for you. For those of you that didn't, please come back in March and go again. And I didn't expect it. It was one of those things that somebody had told me about, said, yo, you got to go to it. You got to go to it. You got to go see it. I said, okay, sure. And I walked in and there was a crowd of, I don't know, 30 or 40 of you sitting there. And the whole thing about the third and seventh step prayer in the chapel is they lay these sheets up near the pulpit. Everybody goes up as a group with their friends, guys that they came with, and they kneel down and they do the third and seventh step prayer publicly. And I said, oh, sure. That sounds like a great idea. So I walk in, and nothing had started yet, and Steve Orr, God bless him, I wish he were here today, you know, Steve got up there after everybody had piled in, and he said, hey, listen, this is what we're going to do. And he finished his announcement and sat down and waited for the first group to go up. And this group of 4 or 5 or 6 guys got up and walked up and centered the sheets and started reading the third step prayer. And I do not know, I don't know to this day what happened right then and there. I do know that I just found myself sitting in the back of the chapel, weeping. And I mean, I had to go up at the very end because I couldn't even do it. And it was one of those really powerful, really profound moments. And even to this day, I mean, listen, you know, I don't know about you guys, but a God of my understanding has to hit me over the head with a 2x4 to get my attention half of the time. But he didn't have to do it that day. Because I knew how big that moment was. Because we talked about the three legacies, right? I've mentioned service and recovery. One that we haven't talked about is unity. So if you guys take a moment just to look around and look out into the crowd and see how many of you all are sitting there. Listen, the reality is that I don't get to recover unless you sit down across from me and say, look, man, this is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to read through, in my opinion, the doctor's opinion. We're going to read through 181. And then we're going to read through all the stories. And then we're going to read through the 12 and 12. And then we're going to make an active, actionable study out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, out of all of the other material that's offered here. But we're going to spend time in the big book, and the 12 and 12. I don't get to recover unless I stay in the middle of the bed, unless I stay in the middle of the program. And for me, staying in the middle of the program is service work. You know, I know when you guys walk up and say, listen, you know, thanks for your service, and I give you my answer, listen, no, I appreciate it. I'm sure some of you think, oh, well, listen, that's just kind of trite. But it's the truth. I serve here because I have to. You all will have to drag me out of here. Not out of service, but out of the men's workshop. But I serve because it's such a passion. Because as Private Doss said very early on, I just want to get one more. Just one more guy. Who just cannot live another day. Who cannot wake up and get up in the morning. And make that same promise that we all made. God, I'm not going to do it again. They wake up, they come to, they come out of a blackout, whatever it is. God, I'm not going to do it again. And hopefully, right after that guy has said that, he's either in this room or he's near a meeting, and us as devoted members of AA and other fellowships get a chance to walk up to that guy and go, I understand. I have been there. And if you want a solution away from how bad it is, if you want a solution from barely being able to pick your head up off the pillow to get up, barely being able to get your head up off the ground, from passing out on the ground or the floor or outside or wherever you are, to barely find enough friends or family or whoever to bail us out again, the solution's here. As Dr. Bob said, we have an answer. You know, the other thing that that you all told me pretty early on, and this is the same kind of challenge that I make to my guys, but I heard it here at the workshop. This is nothing original. Right? But they said, listen, I'll make you a promise. If you go all the way through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, working to the best of your ability, each and every one of the steps in order with the sponsor, and then you get to step 12 and you start carrying the message and you actively start sponsoring other guys. If, after you have started actively sponsoring other men, you are just as miserable when, you know, then as the day you walked in. What would fund more of your misery free of charge? Right? Yeah. And I said, oh, come on, that's not the case. But as it says in the ninth step promises, you know, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And as it says in the 12 step promises and at the end of our book, this is an experience you must not miss. Because if you miss out on that part of the program, you miss out on all three legacies written in one sentence. You know, I had a grand sponsee buddy have the privilege of telling his experience with the 12 steps yesterday. And by the way, before I continue, can we give another hand to all of our speakers this weekend? Not just me. But he said, man, I tell you, I don't know that I'm up. I don't know if I'm up for this. I don't know that I can do it. I said, sure you can, man. It's your story. Who else is going to tell your story? Who else can tell your experience? And if his story, if his experience, if his sharing, his journey from step 1 to step 12 helped one guy sitting in here, whose child has passed, who's lost loved ones in addiction or in sobriety, then his story was sufficient. And his story carried the exact message that God needed him to carry. All of us have different stories. All of us have different experiences. We all have different backgrounds. And every bit of it is important. Every bit of it is important to somebody else. That's why we choose the home groups that we do. That's why we choose the sponsors that we do. That's why the sponsees that walk up to us after a meeting and go, "Hey, listen, you said this in a meeting. It really made an impact. Will you tell me more?" And then after they spend about 15 or 20 minutes in a very roundabout way asking you to be their sponsor without actually directly coming out and saying, "Hey, will you be my sponsor?" And you turn around and say, "What? Yeah, sure, I'll sponsor you." Right? And they hadn't been asked. And you make them the same challenge that a lot of us makes. Just for today, just for right now, just for the time that we are sitting here, will you make me a promise? What's the promise? Are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober from your situation? You know, I'll start to wrap it up. You know, when I first got here, I really thought that I was here to get sober from drugs and alcohol. And I was. I was here to get physically sober from drugs and alcohol. But I had no intention of getting away from the mental obsession. I had no intention of getting away from the spiritual malady. I don't know about you guys, but when I did, I found so much more than just getting away from the physical sobriety. Because for me, you know, as I said before, left up to my own devices, I'm not to be trusted. And it's when I step away from the principles and the practices, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I start to get away and that spiritual malady starts to kick in and I start to get separated. Because what happens? As soon as I've done something dishonest, as soon as I tell a white lie, as soon as I tell some sort of manipulative statement to get things the way I want them, my way, I don't know about you guys, but I get this immediate God hangover. I mean, it's almost instantaneous. I've let down a God of my understanding. I've let down the men in this room, the men who've carried the message. I've let down the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and others. And it's just, you know, it's just a dejection with myself. I'm disappointed with myself. Now, what's the antidote to that? Right? 10th step and the immediate amends. And then right back in the 12th step when I call my sponsees and say, "Listen, this is what I did. This is what I did to rectify it." I know I've been jumping around a little bit, but I do want to talk about 6 and 7 for just a second before I close up. We're asked to get rid of all of our character defects. Getting rid of all my character defects. Are you kidding me? But here's what happens for me. I don't know that I necessarily agree with the term defect. Because to me, that assumes that God's made a mistake. But what I absolutely do have is character extremes. And I want to give you what that example is. Right? I can run any trait of my character, whether it's lying, manipulation, happiness, sadness, joy, depression, anger, whatever it is, all of those are valid emotions. All of those are valid character traits. My problem is that I will run them to extremes. I had one of my sponsees in the car yesterday. We're coming back from Walmart, and there's a car in front of us. And he's not driving like I told him to. Right? And what did I do? I did what many good of us do. I said, "This guy." Right. Caught myself, thanks. "This guy's not doing it right." And I'm immediately not serene. And my sponsee turns and says, "You know, listen, I'm better than I was." I'm like, "Wow. Okay. Thank you for that message, because I needed to hear that. I needed to hear that I'm better than I was. Because I wasn't laying on the horn. I wasn't giving hand directional signals about what they were doing wrong. You know, could have, but I didn't. Right? But it's because of that message that you guys carried to me. That whole mantra about let me get just one more, I mean, that's exactly how I live, whether it's in this program or others. I just want to get one more. I just hope to have one more guy enjoy the privileges of this program that I've enjoyed for the last 20 plus years. Because I don't enjoy that without you guys. And I want to finish up by reading a couple of paragraphs from something. Some of you all will recognize it. There's a passage by Sam Shoemaker called I Stand at the Door. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's fairly lengthy, but I do want to read the first couple of paragraphs. It says, I stand at the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It's the door through which men walk when they find God. There's no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside as they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only a wall there where a door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched hands, groping hands, feeling for the door, knowing there must be a door. Yet they never find it. So I stand at the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door. The door to God. The most important thing that any man can do is take hold of one of those blind, groping hands. Put it on the latch. The latch that only clicks and opens to the man's touch. The door to God. Guys, I hope you all will stand with me on that wall, waiting for somebody to come up and say, man, I need a solution. I cannot live like this anymore. I cannot go on. I don't know what to do. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I just know I can't do it this way anymore. And if you stick around long enough, if you work hard enough, you can stand on the wall. Reach your hand out and say, here it is. It's the door to your home group. It's the door to the Atlanta Men's Workshop. It's the door to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the door to God. Thanks, gentlemen, for letting me share it.